G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. I don't have anything much to say about the catastrophe in Sydney over the weekend. It's obviously heartbreaking. The only things that I could say would be platitudes. It's interesting to notice one's emotional roller coaster as the facts come to light and the sense of relief that it's not ethnically motivated, that it's not evidence of some kind of problem with Australian multiculturalism, some kind of cultural schism, some sort of religious backlash, some kind of importation of foreign feuds, ancient rivalries onto Australian shores, that it's not an act of jihadist terrorism or, I don't know, ultra-Zionist extremism. And yet, when all of that has been ruled out, and all you're left with is a 40-year-old schizophrenic man who currently doesn't have a permanent address, coming from Queensland into Sydney, renting a small storage locker, and subsequently entering a shopping mall with a huge knife and slaughtering mostly women, injuring a 9-month-old baby, killing her mother. The mother threw the baby to a bystander to save its life. And then the incredible courage of a female police officer who ran into the melee and instructed the gentleman to drop his weapon, and when he refused and apparently lunged at her, she shot him dead. When you strip away all the fears about it being part of some grander plot targeting specific communities, what are you left with then? Is it a more reassuring picture of the world? That random psychotic barbarism just unleashes itself occasionally in these very normal, safe spaces? Or is it less reassuring? There's been so much nonsensical chatter on social media about, to all of you people who are expressing heartbreak at this, where is your heartbreak about the Gazans? And if you haven't been talking every day about Gaza, and now you're posting about white people, about white victims, oh, is that your attitude towards white victims? That only white bodies count, do they? It's so monumentally unempathetic and so clueless about human emotion. As if there'd been a shooting in a shopping mall in Sri Lanka, Sri Lankans wouldn't also care more about that than they do about Gaza. As if anyone anywhere of any colour wouldn't care more about things that happen to their peers in their place than they do about things elsewhere. What does it have to do with colour? I've also heard people on social media saying, oh, these are white tears. This is what white people are so self-absorbed, that the moment just 6 people are killed, they make it all about them. When this is the kind of violence that people of colour have been enduring for decades, nay, centuries. Similarly ridiculous. I mean, there are parts of the world which are prosperous and peaceful and are inhabited by majority people of colour, where an event like this would be a bolt from the blue and completely catastrophic. And then there are other places which are majority white, which are tearing each other apart, like Ukraine, where an event like this wouldn't even register a blip in their consciousness. What's relevant is the background level of violence and the assumption of peace, not the skin colour of the people involved. I mean, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the argument, incidentally, that we should care a lot more about things that are happening abroad than we do about things that happen close to us. I remember my first journalism class at university, I was the contrarian who was arguing that local news is stupid. You know, there's no point. Who cares that a baby fell out of a third floor window in a neighborhood near mine? Like, that's not news. Tell me about what's going on in the world. Tell me about things that are happening that are important. Tell me about scientific breakthroughs. Tell me about geopolitical crises. Why is something important just because it happened near me? I have some sympathy for that. But I'd have more sympathy for the online influencers who are chastising everybody in Australia for caring so much about the mass stabbing, the mass killing, if it wasn't also so obvious that the only things overseas they care about are the ones that happen to have been put right in front of them by an algorithm on their smartphone, and which caring about gives them enormous credibility and status in the social justice ecosystem that they're part of. You know, if one of them wanted to start caring deeply about the million Muslims who were being driven out of Pakistan into probable injury, possible starvation, possible death in Afghanistan, then I'd have some respect for that. I'd be like, oh, okay, well, that's an unusual thing for you to care about. Good for you. Or if they took up the plight of refugees in some benighted part of Africa. Yeah, okay, that's great. Oh, no, it's not that, is it? All your finger-wagging about how self-absorbed we are for caring about the slaughter of our own is predicated on you making your appropriate social justice moves about the conflict du jour which you happen to have noticed on your phone and are suddenly deeply interested in when you never gave a shit about Gazans up until 3 minutes ago when Mark Zuckerberg popped it in front of your face. Anyway, all of that is perhaps a ranty prelude to today's conversation. I wanted to pick the brain of ideally an anti-Zionist, although it sounds to me like Aina, our guest today, is somewhat conflicted about whether or not she is really an anti-Zionist. But I suppose the uncomfortable conversation that we're considering, or the uncomfortable idea, is whether or not Israel's catastrophic conduct in Gaza, its, from my perspective, morally inexcusable excesses, the horrendous cataclysms being wrought on innocent people in Gaza, and the disregard for the dignity and sanctity of human life of Palestinians, whether that calls into question the legitimacy of the state of Israel, and whether it's kosher, pardon the pun, kosher, or the term kosher, for people in the West to use the catastrophe in Gaza as a way of relentlessly focusing on the ills of Israel and talking about Zionism in a way that at least rhymes with anti-Semitic tropes of the past. So I wanted to find someone in the West who had been posting on social media relentlessly in a way that was supportive of Gazans and critical of Israel, but who also had some understanding of the Middle East. Aina came to mind because she was a blogger, she's an illustrator, she's a podcaster. Her podcast is called Polite Conversations, in contrast to Uncomfortable Conversations. And she grew up in Saudi Arabia. So I figure someone who grew up in Saudi Arabia and is of Pakistani heritage and ancestry, but lives in Canada, lives in the West, lives in North America, has imbibed the leftist, leftist is pejorative, the progressive left social justice attitude towards Israel and Gaza, would be a great person to talk to about this. I hope this is useful. It is something of a clash. I'm grateful to Aina for having put her hand up and been this person. I want to have more conversations about this with a greater variety of minds in the future. I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. I hope you're peaceful. If you're an Australian listener who was in some way touched by what happened, I'm just tearing up a little because I didn't know one of the people personally, but that person is a friend of a friend, and that shopping centre, that mall, is a place where I take my kids every few weeks, and used to take them when they were little babies. And the idea that that just normal background habit, that part of your daily or weekly experience, could be shattered so suddenly and so bloodily and so violently is, it's shocking. It's traumatizing. It's absolutely nothing in comparison to what so many people around the world are going through. I know that. I understand the comparison, but it just makes me feel so blessed, so grateful to live in the societies that we do. So I hope you're well, and I hope all your loved ones are well. Much love. Enjoy this conversation with the one and only Aina.
You're a riddle wrapped in an enigma. Nobody knows what you are. I don't even know what you look like.
Yes, this is true.
This is true.
Not many people do.
Yeah.
But it's
why
not.
Why did you, I'd forgotten about that. Why did you make that choice?
So why I started to do that is because I used to be a blogger, specifically about sex and sexuality in Pakistan. And then that
yes.
started to extend to generally, you know, talking about Islam and how that impacts sexuality and women and things like that. And I started getting a lot of, well, actually, I was anonymous before I started blogging about that, so I anticipated getting a lot of threats. And I
You're
did.
Not suggesting that there could be a certain level of violent intolerance in the Muslim world?
In a lot of the world, that's not the only place I get threats from. But yes, no, I wouldn't deny it. Look, I'm a critic of the religion I left behind. I will never, you'll never find me apologizing for places like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, which are the two countries that I'm connected to, which is why I'm having a particularly hard time understanding like this connection and defensiveness around Israel that a lot of people are feeling.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think, yeah, I empathize with you on that because I mean, I'm in a similar boat. Being a grandson of Holocaust survivors, mm-hmm. you know, there's an expectation that I'm going to take a reflexively pro-Israel stance, and it's tricky. I mean, but I think that's what being a thinking person is to try to wrestle with complicated issues. I don't think there's anything contradictory about my believing that the right-wing Israeli coalitions are catastrophic for everybody, and that Netanyahu is a corrupt little hack, and that the policy of building settlements in the West Bank is criminal and insane, and that Palestinians deserve a state, and that what's happening in Gaza is horrific, and then also feeling conflicted about like calls for a ceasefire at a point when you would just have jihadists back in control in an area. Like, I think if a person doesn't find the oldest and most intractable geopolitical problem in the world complicated, and if it doesn't raise ambivalent feelings in them, then they probably don't know enough about it, is my general
instinct. I think it's
instinct.
Getting less and less complicated by the day, though. Like,
yeah, so tell me what's your framing? I mean, big picture, because I'm less interested in, like, should they have bombed this hospital, or should that person have been, like, I mean, of course, like, war is fucking catastrophic, so it's horrendous. But what's the big,
yeah.
what's your
but
kind
war
of big
also,
picture?
War also involves two countries, at least, right? Like, that are actually warring with each other. I don't even accept that this is a war, really. It's like a terrorist group that is being bombed by a well-funded military.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, I'm happy to make a semantic distinction there if you want. In that context, like, you know, the campaign against ISIS in Syria in 2015 would also not have been a war per se. It's just trying to get jihadists to stop jihading.
Sure, yeah. But I think this is different because of the the type of control that Israel has over the population. The Palestinian population and the kind of control that it's had over it for decades. So that's not exactly the same as how America had control over the populations that it was bombing. Awful, just the same. But I find that this is unique in a lot of ways, actually.
Mm. Can you articulate those ways?
Let me just start with my basic framing. When you reached out to me, you said that you're looking for anti-Zionist perspectives to come on your show.
Yeah.
So before October 7th, I never I never even thought about the term anti-Zionist very much, to be honest with you. I still wouldn't really go around talking about how I'm this anti-Zionist because I'm still undecided on how useful that term is. However, I do think it's becoming easier to talk about it because there are so many left-wing Jewish voices that are making the distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism very clear, which I think has been a very deliberate tactic for a long, long time to conflate the two and muddy the water and make people uncomfortable about criticizing Israel. And, you know, coming from the atheist scene, that's what's been most eye-opening to me because this is like a scene that has talked about weaponization of the word Islamophobia. And I've always been like, you know, on the side of course, I don't like when conservatives weaponize that term. I've always stood against it. I've always criticized it. So it's really shocking to me to see the same kinds of people that talked about how, or are still talking about how Islamophobia is just not a real thing, even when they know that it actually refers to anti-Muslim bigotry. It may be an imperfect term, and I've heard plenty of Jewish people describe anti-Semitism as an imperfect term, and also homophobia as an imperfect term, right? So if we're going to get pedantic about terms, we're just going to get bogged down in it. If we can understand it to mean anti-Muslim bigotry, then I don't see why someone would say that that's a fake thing, because that's a very real thing. Similarly, anti-Semitism is a very real and concerning thing. I've used my platform to talk about it a lot. But what I really dislike is the conflation of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
It's interesting that you say that because in November, I went on Sky News After Dark, which is like the evening programming in Australia is basically like Fox News. It's, you know, right wing. And they got me on to talk about anti-Semitism because I'd done an episode of my podcast trying to wrestle with how conflicted I was about the whole situation and how conflicted I was about the ways in which, I guess, anti-Zionism was starting to be used in extremely aggressive ways that smelled a bit like anti-Semitism. And the host of the show, she was basically making the argument that anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism were the same thing, and that if you're anti-Zionist, you are an anti-Semite. And I pushed back firmly on her and took, you know, the side that you just articulated on that, saying, hang on. This always gets trotted out by in a cynical way by right-wing Israeli governments to try to provide them with cover from any legitimate criticism. It has to be possible to criticize the policies of Israeli governments without this lazy slur of being an anti-Semite. And it actually makes it harder to fight real anti-Semitism when people feel like anti-Semitism is just a, you know, an ass-covering tactic that the most far-right, you know, orthodox religious pandering pro-settler Likudnik can trot out in order to absolve themselves of criticism. And yet at the same time as that, there's been since October 7th, I've also had like a sort of shifting relationship with Zionism. There are times in my life when I've said that I'm not a Zionist. It just feels like
I was going to say, Josh, I looked at some of your old tweets on Israel, and, you know, I found them completely in line with like, what I would think now.
Do you remember what they were? I mean, I'd be fascinated. I haven't done an archaeology of my opinions.
I can't remember the exact words, but you were like, oh, this is, you know, this is obvious racism and this is not a country that's for me or something like that.
Yeah. I feel like since 2008, since the country's rightward lurch and the abandonment of any pretense of peace and the cynicism of the Netanyahu governments, it has just become a state that I feel no sympathy for in the way that it's enacting its governments. And yet, even as I say that, I feel like a little twinge in my belly of discomfort because my country of Australia has done all kinds of things that I object to. And the United States of America has done all kinds of things that I object to. So what's happened since October 7th that has, I guess, rudely awakened me to becoming more of a Zionist, I guess, is that the anti-Zionist coalition has started emerging in ways that sound quite bloodthirsty against Jews There's a lot of rhetoric about.
Now, do you mean by that? Because I've heard people say that, and then you ask them what it is, and they're like, oh, it's people that are saying from the river to the sea.
No, Palestine, I don't just mean that. I mean okay. there was quite a lot of activity on social media around, like, you know, the Zionist colonial settlers will stop at nothing to satisfy their bloodlust. You know, there's nothing Zionists love more than, you know, bombing babies and killing women. You know, the Zionist campaign, the power-hungry Zionists won't stop until they've decimated every village. Like, if
but,
you swap
but they
out...
are decimating places and things.
Well, of course, but I mean, if you said, you know, the Arabs will stop at nothing before they've raped every Jew with a Kalashnikov, you know, it wouldn't.
That's more
Why?
Like saying Jew, right? Arab.
Yeah, that. But that's what I'm implying.
Zionist.
But I'm saying that Zionist is getting used in ways like there are timeless tropes about Jews that they're bloodthirsty, that they like drinking the blood of babies,
course.
That
yes.
they're power hungry. That they're shadowy, sinister figures behind the scenes, that they're at once supremely powerful, but also groveling, sniveling, rat-eating paupers. You know, they're communists,
yeah.
but
yeah.
they're also capitalists. Like, they're all these mm-hmm. things. And I'm not saying that the people who say this stuff on social media have any clue about that, but it is just interesting that every half century or so we see an uprising in particular characteristics. Like, there are, war is terrible. So you're going to bomb... You're going to bomb buildings in a war. That doesn't mean that you have to say that the project of giving Jews a homeland is intrinsically linked with the lust that quote-unquote Zionists, which I feel is sort of coded as Jew, have for blood. I mean, I don't think it's fair to say that people who want an Israeli state to exist are motivated by their delight in what's going on in Gaza.
Okay, let me respond to that. So I agree with you that some of the people that use Zionists use it in this very kind of coded way, which is why I say to you that I'm not entirely sure about the usefulness of the term, but like it's a, like not everyone uses it that way, right? You also have people
sure.
who are using that as a cover, like you say, to say that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism and you can't criticize Israel. So you have like the whole spectrum of people that are masquerading as simply anti-Zionist, but they're hiding their anti-Semitism. And, you know, I think it's important for people that are on the pro-Palestine side to call that out repeatedly. I have done that in every conversation that I've had about Israel. I think it's very important to couple your criticism of Israel with your dislike of anti-Semitism to show that there's no space for anti-Semitism in my preferred type of movement that is criticizing Israel. It's completely separate. Now, when you say it's just war and war is bad and you're going to bomb things, there's some unique things about this war, right? So first of all, the death toll of the children, I think within 5 months, it was like over 10,000 children. Whereas in comparison, if you look at Ukraine, obviously any single child dying is horrific. But it, by comparison, I think the death toll of children in Ukraine over 2 years was like 500. And then there are reports coming from doctors, from Israeli doctors and human rights organizations, that there's evidence that the IDF is deliberately targeting and shooting at children. Now, I know that there are tropes and awful things like that, but when you, like a force that has this kind of impunity to act in ways that are crazy-makingly, yes, they sound sometimes like the tropes, like, yes, killing babies and things like that, but they're actually killing babies at a rate that is higher than a lot of what we've seen.
So, I mean, but one of the, I mean, anti-Semitism is a tricky thing because I think what a lot of Jews feel is also a type of anti-Semitism is the habitual double standard that is applied to Jews and Israel that isn't applied to other places. So, parking for a moment the, whatever that anecdotal report is about the IDF shooting children. That's
not anecdotal.
That's not a verifiable. If there is an Israeli soldier who is shooting an unarmed child, that soldier is going to be hauled before a tribunal, and they're not going to be a soldier anymore, and they will probably do time in jail.
No, not necessarily.
That has not been verified by. I mean, you can send me whatever you've got on it, but I've been following
it
reasonably closely. And I mean, if you want to do a what about game, like how each side treats the other side. You know, you do have a population who voted in a jihadist group that then broke into Israel and, like, sliced apart women and raped their corpses.
Sure.
So that's also not a good thing.
Absolutely not. As I said, they're a terrorist group, but, like, most of that
population... I mean, they're a terrorist group who the population voted for, and they've been functioning as a government.
But most of that population is underage currently. Like, they're not adults, so...
No, I know, it's terrible. Yeah, it's fucking awful. I know. I mean, but... This is why I don't want to sort of get into like, well, how are they doing particularly too much, or are they being particularly careless? Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that there are ways in which there should be more aid getting in. I'm sure that there are catastrophes in the fog of war. What I don't quite understand is why right now this particular conflict, which just as an aside, when we talk about the civilian casualties of the conflict, the civilian casualty ratio is not terrible in Gaza because there are so many jihadists. I mean, it's a weird and cruel thing to say, but even if you accept like Hamas's Gaza Health Ministry figures, the civilian ratio is something like 2-1, meaning that for every combatant who's killed, 2 civilians have died. That's Hamas numbers. Israel's numbers are like, you know, 1.2-1. And our civilian casualty in World War II was about the same, was like 2-1. And in the Iraq War, it was like 4.5-1 or something in terms of the Iraq War was much more deadly for civilians in comparison to the number of baddies who we were killing.
But you have
not
you to have
mention
to look
like
the
firebombing of Dresden in World War II or like what was Hiroshima. I mean, like completely different scales of targeting of civilians.
Again. Dresden was how many years ago now? Like our moral standards also shift according to the
time. I don't think they do because I don't think we do think of World War II as being a barbaric war on our part.
No, I think a lot of people have talked about the civilian casualties. Like we certainly don't operate at those standards now.
Well, we certainly don't think about World War II through the prism of the conflict, you know, the total disregard for civilian life on the part of the Allies means that their project was flawed, the way we do with Israel.
Pardon the interruption. I just want to tell you about a video that I want you to check out. It features the one and only Chuck Norris. You remember Chuck Norris? The man's in his 80s, and, you know, I'm no spring chicken. Nonetheless, I care about my health. I want to live a long time. I want to be healthy. I don't always get as many fruits and vegetables and herbs that are supposed to increase my energy levels in my own diet. So I saw this video that Chuck Norris has made. He's kicking butt. He's working out. He's staying active. He has heaps of energy left over for his grandkids and so on. And he says that he is achieving all this by making one single change. And he feels like he's in his 50s. Go to mymorningkick.com/Josh and watch Chuck Norris's video right now. That's mymorningkick.com/Josh, mymorningkick.com/Josh.
Sorry, can the implication, you repeat that?
Yeah, the implication at the moment seems to be Israel is killing a shit ton of civilians, therefore it's in the wrong in the war, it shouldn't be allowed to win the war, and its whole status as a state should be questioned. We don't use that logic with the Allies in World War II.
No, but it's not a comparable situation, and I'm not talking about its status as a state in general. I'm talking really about the way that it functions right now as a state that has besieged a population, is controlling their caloric intake, controls even outside of anything that happened before October 7th, controlled who could collect rainwater, how they fish, like every aspect of their lives, where they go, when they come, when they go back home. these are not like aspects of a normal society.
No, I mean, it was cruel and it would have totally sucked to live in Gaza. But does Israel do that to Palestinians in the West Bank?
You know, Israel holds their children without charge in the West Bank.
Wait, does Israel impose the kind of, like, if you want to call it, you know, caloric restriction, intense embargo, checking everything that goes in and out of the West Bank?
I believe
So they weren't doing it to Gaza because they're Palestinians. They were doing it to Gaza because Gaza was run by jihadists.
Yeah, but that's collective punishment, though, right? And well,
the Palestinians voted for a government that was so bad that, does October 7th give you any reason to think that the Israelis might have had a point about why they wanted to be careful about what went in and out of Gaza?
No, because you're talking about millions of people.
It's tragic, you're talking about millions of people who are basically hostages to a terrorist group of jihadists who have said, October 7th, again and again, that they will kill as many Jews as they can. And when they had a chance, they did. So you'd want to make sure that you sort of know what's going in and out.
If we're talking about rhetoric, let's talk about what Israeli officials have said, right? And they're not terrorists, yet they sound no better than Hamas, right? Talking about flattening Gaza, Palestinian children have brought this upon themselves. Gaza.
As I've said, I'm no fan of Netanyahu's government, and I'm even less of a fan of his right-wing coalition partners. They've even, you know, it's like completely, I think, morally insane. Like even just a couple of weeks ago, the hard-right finance minister, Smotrich, said that he was annexing another 2,500 acres of the West Bank for settlements. And he said that from the river to the sea, like Israel is going to control everything.
Because
he said Judea and Samaria. Yeah, yeah, totally. However, we know what happens when Israel controls all of the Palestinian territories because it's been doing so. It's not nice, but what's the counter vision if the Palestinians control all that territory? Would it be nicer or less nice?
But you can't frame it like that because we
don't know.
Why not?
They both want it from the river to the sea.
Well, we don't know what the Palestinians would be like had they been allowed to thrive, had they been allowed to exist a normal life. Like, can't like hold a population
hostage. Well, we do. Well, no, we do.
And then call them savage.
I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. It's very, yes, it's like, of course, a population that has been so traumatized is going to be dysfunctional in many ways. I completely take that. But it's not like they had suffered that in 1948 when they also didn't take a state and decided to invade Israel. And it's not like they'd been occupied in 1967 when they tried to wipe all the Jews out of the Middle East again. And it's not like they'd been occupied. I mean, they'd only been occupied for 6 years when they tried again in 1973.
Before that Jews and Muslims and Christians in the region had coexisted for centuries. But I want to go back to the West Bank.
I mean, that's sort of a nice myth that people who favor a one-state solution peddle. Yeah, they were there. I mean, there were almost a million
Noah
Jews.
Noah Harari said that on Sam Harris's podcast.
Look, it's true. They were there for a very long time. There were almost a million Jews across, like living in what are currently Arab countries prior to 1948. But through the 30s and 40s, they were increasingly subjected to pogroms and, you know,
look,
having their shops and houses burned.
I'm not denying that. But when they got to Israel, we should also talk about how the Arab Jews were treated there, how they were sprayed with pesticide, how they were, you know, de-Arabized, so to say, what happened to the Yemeni Jews' children, things like that.
Yeah, it was
and
nasty.
And also, to go back to the West Bank, you were saying, right, they don't do this to the Palestinians in the West Bank. Well, what they do in the West Bank is that they hold their children, they kidnap them without charge, and they hold them, and they live under Israeli military law. They are officially the only children in the world who are systematically prosecuted in military courts. And over 10,000 have been held in the Israeli military detention system just over charges like stone throwing, for which they get sentences like 20 years.
It's awful. Is that better or worse than what would happen to Jewish children if Hamas or the Palestinian Authority controlled Israel?
Again, that's not a fair framing.
But that's the reality of what we're actually dealing with. Like, that is the reason why I think Israelis get frustrated with the double standard is like, yes, okay. So
the double standard, Josh, it seems to be in Israel's favor. I don't think anyone is allowed to operate.
The double standard is people like you spend all their time talking about how bad what Israel is doing is. And
I barely talked about Israel.
Well, when you talk about what a terrible situation the Palestinians are in, it's implicit because, of course, they're in that situation by implication because of Israel's
behavior. I talk about Israel plenty now because what I'm seeing is shocking beyond belief. But I tell you why it's disorienting to me, because if anything, I was biased in favor of Israel because being an ex-Muslim, you can get kind of angry. Like, I have now over the years become very critical of what the ex-Muslim movement has become, of what the atheist movement has become. To me, that is like just a right-wing cesspit. Like, but I am not like some kind of fan of Islam and defender of Islam.
So
I grew up in Saudi Arabia. The state, you know, I have experienced all those injustices, what they do with women, how they treat minorities, all of that. I won't be apologizing for that. But what's shocking to me is that I grew up thinking this is the worst kind of oppression, right? Like what a woman might experience in Iran or Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia. But then the more I read about what Israel is doing and how it frames itself as a liberal democracy, it just does not match up. Like, this is not how a liberal democracy operates.
Yeah.
Like, Saudi Arabia sucks, but you'll never find it pretending to be inclusive and a liberal democracy, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of the challenge, right? That, yeah, Israel, to some extent, brings on itself the double standard by, you know, its participation in the club of progressive liberal democratic countries.
Right.
So it gets judged by that standard. If you actually look at the neighborhood that it's in, then, of course, if you had a choice of moving back to Saudi Arabia or moving to Tel Aviv, I mean, I assume you'd choose Tel Aviv.
No, not from what I've heard. I don't know what kind of prejudice I'm going to face as a person of Muslim background. Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia sucks, but I know what it is, right?
Well, maybe you should do more research then.
No, I have.
Or maybe you should go to Israel. I mean, are you aware that there
are? I don't want to go to a place that has such horrific records on human rights, like. They have, since October 7th, arrested dozens of Israeli citizens, Arabs, for posting any solidarity.
I mean, Ina, I'm literally speechless. Like, the Tel Aviv Gay Parade is one of the biggest gay parties in the world. It is a town that is full of Arabs and Jews and gays and feminists. It is
a
progressive part of the world. Well, yeah, it's the impression because you just say that it's the impression because you don't know anything about it. I mean, there are Arabs who are on the Supreme Court of Israel. There are Arabs. There's an Arab party that is part of the democratic process. There are Arabs in the parliament. The idea that you would go to Tel Aviv and feel potentially more oppressed and more constrained and less free than you would in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
I said I don't know.
Yeah, then I'm saying you probably should know if you're going to comment on this issue.
No, I can't know how I'm going to be treated if I go there, because from what I see Palestinians being treated,
you could talk to Arabs who live in Tel Aviv.
I have, and I'm telling you, they have been arrested for simply posting. This is a Saudi Arabia type of Orwellian oppression, where you can't just say solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza right now. You're going to go to prison for that? Like, it's ridiculous.
I mean,
this is what I would expect from Saudi Arabia.
There are hate speech rules in Scotland where you can't misgender somebody and you'll go to jail. Every country has its weird quirks about ways in which it overreaches. Like, I could say, well, I don't know. I haven't. I'm telling you that's not what happens in Israel. It's like, I could say, well, I don't know. I haven't been to Glasgow. I don't know what it's like in Glasgow. Maybe I'd rather move to Yemen than to Glasgow because I've heard reports that in Glasgow, the police arrest people for just saying things or putting up posters.
Because I am from Canada. I have heard Jordan Peterson do this bit, and not a single person has been arrested for misgendering someone. That's just how he grifted his way to fame. But, you can think about these things objectively. Does that sound like having your children taken away for stone throwing for possibly 20 years and then being tried in military court? That sounds to me like the kind of stuff that morality police would do in Saudi Arabia. Like, they were terrifying. And
that's in the West Bank. But I mean, the question of, I don't know how you don't see that it's a double standard when you're talking about a conflict between a jihadist group and a country that is behaving in the way that you're talking about. That country needs to secure itself somehow, presumably, if you believe in that country's, you know, we talk about the right to exist, but if you believe that it's there and people live there and they've been living there for generations, their people have been there for thousands of years since the kingdom of King David, they're now doing something really awful to the neighbors who tried to kill them repeatedly. Because they don't know what to do about the neighbors.
What has Israel tried to do before that? Like, they've also done the same. You know what I'm saying?
No, Israel isn't
acknowledged.
No. What do you mean? Israel hasn't tried to demolish and annihilate Palestine. I mean, Israel is Israel. Israel tried to give Palestine back to the Palestinians. It was happy to have a Palestinian state next to it in 1948. We had the Oslo Accords. You know, we had various peace processes. We had Camp David. The Palestinians do not want what the majority of Israelis had traditionally wanted, which was two states. The Palestinians want the whole pie. That's the core of the problem.
I just don't think that they've been given a fair shot at reasonable two states. Like, this is not how two states operate, where one population is a hostage and on the other...
No, of course not.
So, okay.
Of course not. But
also,
I mean, in 1993, they tried. In 1999, they tried. In 2008, Olmert tried. It always comes down to basically...
Yeah, but they've always been trying to keep Palestine not from succeeding. They have admitted as much. They have admitted as much repeatedly.
Succeeding means becoming militarized so that they can keep firing rockets into Israel, yes.
Economically. Economic strangulation. They have talked about that. They don't want it to
not in the
succeed.
Plans that they're offering. Not when they're talking about a two-state solution.
They're not going to be like, hey, look, let's economically strangle you, and will you accept that? No, that's not how it works. But that is why, Netanyahu has funded and helped Hamas out. Because he does not want Palestine to succeed. But
I mean, the bulk of Hamas's funding comes from international aid, which instead of spending on the Palestinian people, it spends on rockets and tunnels. I agree with you that Netanyahu's been cynical in playing off Hamas against the Palestinian Authority in order to drive a wedge between Palestinians and make Palestinian statehood less likely. And I've always been critical of that. I think it's shameful. But the idea that, you know, the only impediment to Palestinian statehood has been Israeli intransigence rather than a combination of Israeli intransigence and Palestinian refusal to accept anything less than of Israel.
But I think that Palestinians haven't really had a shot at it because of the way that they have been living for decades. So
they hadn't been living that way in 1948 or 1967 or 1973 or... 1993 when they rejected the peace overture, or 2000 when they rejected the peace process, or 2008 when they rejected the peace process. Like, what?
When was the Nakba?
1948.
Right. So then what happened then?
They were offered a state. They were given a state.
And they just chose to leave instead?
No, they chose to invade Israel and try to destroy Israel.
I don't think, but look, so the idea was that it was a land for people, what's the slogan? A land for people.
A land without people for a people without a land was the Zionist slogan.
That's just not what it was, right?
No, it wasn't.
If you're
that's
just living there and then suddenly you're like, hey, how about you have this portion of it? You're not going to accept
that.
Yeah,
of course. I understand that psychologically it feels like it sucks because, like, you know, it's like someone comes into your country, says, all right, you get this half of it, you get that half of it. But, I mean, to be fair, Jews were also there, right? I mean, I think there's this illusion that Israel is a colonial settler country.
Some certainly were. Some certainly
The majority of Jewish Israelis are descended from people who were in the Middle East. They haven't been parachuted in from, like, Orthodox Russia.
Yes, they're from the Middle East, but not specifically from there. Not that exact.
Well, do you want to discuss why they're from the rest of the Middle East?
I'm not denying it, right? We've already.
It's because 800,000 Jews in 1948 were living up in the Arab world and were driven out and persecuted. I mean, they weren't even allowed to leave Syria. Yes. If you were caught trying to flee Syria as a Jew to go to Israel, then you were either shot or sent to a slave labor camp.
If you listen to some Mizrahi Jews, like Avi Shlaim, I believe he's of Iraqi background, he will say that there were centuries of harmony, and this history of European Jewish persecution, as awful as it is, was not the history of Middle Eastern Jews. But
that's
as
true.
A response,
that sounds to me a little bit like saying the history of Palestinians is not one of violent struggle. They're only violent now because of all of the oppression that they've gone through. It's a sort of abstract academic claim that doesn't really relate to the world as it now stands. So yes, I'm sure that in the 1700s there were fantastic souks and bazaars across the Arab world where Jews and Arabs shopped together. But the reality is that in the 20th century there was rising anti-Semitism, rising conflict in part because of Jews, right? In part because of the whole Zionist movement in the late 1800s driving more and more Jews to have this sense that this will be a homeland one day. And so terrible things were done to the Arabs who were living in what is now Israel. And even more terrible things were done to even more Jews across the whole Arab world. And the 800,000 Jews who were living in the Arab world, there were 150,000 in Iraq. They were driven out to Israel. There were 15,000 in Syria. They were driven out to
Israel. But do you think that
Israel.
That gives people a reason to do what they're doing right now to the Palestinians?
No.
Like, I would never say that you should, you know, eliminate Israel or drive out the people that live there and they should go back to I don't know where. Like, I don't think that's a practical solution. There are people that already live there. There are people that have been living there, and driving more people out as well as what the Palestinians have gone through, I don't think that's going to help anything. But strategically, do you think it makes sense to achieve peace? Like, Israel was supposed to be this project that provided Jews a safe haven, and it seems to have not succeeded in that.
No,
it has. So I don't think indiscriminately bombing an entire besieged population, starving them, I don't think that that is good for the safety of anybody, even those of us who are not in that region at all.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't think it's good for the safety of Jews anywhere in the diaspora for this conflict to be going on, and I don't think it's been good for the future prospects of Israel to be ruled by right-wingers for the past 15 years. However, just in looking at the landscape of reaction to this current conflict, the reason I raise things like the 800,000 Jews who were driven out of Arab countries and into Israel is not to say that they should be able to go back, but to say that if the claim is that Palestinians should be able to return to Israel proper, and that's actually the sticking point that has generally prevented any of these peace deals from coming through, the right of return, they call it, you know, that all across
people seem to have to Israel, random people that are not connected to the region.
Well, Jews. Let me just finish the thought about the right of return. I was in Lebanon, in Beirut, and was talking to a lovely Palestinian guy. This poor guy, all he wanted to do was travel the world, and he had places that he wanted to see, and he can't because he's a Palestinian refugee, and Lebanon doesn't give him any rights. Now, when I say he's a refugee, I mean he's a guy in his early 20s, late teens. He's never been to Palestine or Israel. His grandparents were driven out of Israel, and he's treated by Lebanon as a Palestinian refugee. The poor Palestinian diaspora is shat upon by Arab countries in ways. You know, they're not allowed. You know, if you wanted to be humane about Palestinians, then we'd spend as much time prior to October 7th, at least, criticizing Lebanon and Egypt and the Gulf states.
I think a lot of Muslims do
more.
That.
Well, it certainly doesn't get the Muslim street inflamed the same way that when you talk about the Jewish Zionist state does.
No,
you don't get the same marches.
Because look at the difference. They're not letting, they're being mean and not letting the Palestinian refugees in. Okay, that's awful. But what Israel is doing is completely on a different scale.
I said prior to October 7th.
Even then, like it's controlling their calories and rainwater and fishing and building and whether they have access to chocolate and cilantro.
Do you think that the people who are, you know, the moment you talk about the Zionist fascist state in, I don't know, Malaysia, and Muslims come out and march and chant and burn Zionist flags, do you think they know the difference between the policy of embargo in Gaza versus the settlement policy in the West Bank versus Lebanon's attitude towards not giving citizenship to Palestinian refugees? Do you think they care about any of that?
I'm sure many of them do, but what you're implying is that they're just like bloodthirsty anti-Semites, or
I'm arguing that they're sort of victims of a narrative that's very easy to understand, which is a very long-standing hatred of Jews and suspicion of the Jewish state. Gets applied in a way that's totally different. I mean, you can go to Somalia and talk to get a random Muslim in Somalia and ask them what they think of the Jews, and that person won't have even met anyone who's ever met anyone who's ever met anyone who's ever met a Jew, and they'll have quite strong opinions that they've learned about in their mosque about Jews. I don't believe doesn't feed into the excitement about Israel.
Listen, I have talked about anti-Semitism in the Muslim world specifically on my own platform. I have written about it. I have podcasted about it. I'm well aware of it, but I also would like you to think about the fact that maybe it is the actions of Israel that are enraging, and they reach for this like scripture-backed anti-Semitism.
Yeah, like, I mean, it certainly doesn't help. It is not helping right now. I will grant you that.
But
whether
like,
or not the anger predates,
not everything is just about like this unique hatred of specifically Israel for no reason at all.
There's a good reason, but I mean the fundamental. But I'm trying to tease out how much of the good reason is what Israel is doing right now, and how much of the good reason is that they just basically don't think there should be Jews in the Middle East.
Yeah, but then you look at like states like Saudi Arabia, which are trying to normalize. You know what I'm saying? I think that they would be perfectly fine if it benefited them strategically.
Well, it depends who you're talking about. I mean, MBS, like the Crown Prince, would be fine because he's, you know, he has his own interests and mm-hmm. the royal family has its own interests. But the Arab mm-hmm. street in Saudi Arabia, I dare say, is probably not as keen on normalization with Israel as he is. I don't know. I haven't seen polling, but that would be my hunch.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's because of the way the situation has been and is now and is getting worse. Like, we can't speculate on what it would be like if Israel actually treated Palestine. Like, you know, you talk about this anti-Semitism that is coming from Arabs, but you have to also acknowledge that the deep-seated anti-Muslim hate and anti-Arab hate that is spread throughout Israeli society. Like, I don't know if you've seen any of these TikToks that where they're dressing up as like Palestinians, just like that have experienced explosions.
I mean, Ida, you know how deranging social media is when you cherry pick incidents of like, you see 15 incidents of some crazy Israeli,
no, it's not 15.
You know, deranged it's religious Jew talking about how all Muslims are animals, and that becomes a proxy for
just religious Israel. People. It's all across the political spectrum.
Well, I suggest you go to Israel liberal. And sit in a cafe. I suggest you go and sit in a cafe in Tel Aviv and see how you feel, and see whether you feel oppressed and afraid, or whether you feel liberated.
Well, I just what I'm saying right now is anecdotal. A lot of what I was saying before is not anecdotal because these are actual reports.
I mean, if you want to know the difference, Aina, between the attitudes towards Muslims in Israel and the attitudes towards Jews in Palestine, you only have to look at the way that each country and each people behave when they have the other in their midst. I mean, in Israel, there are Muslims and Arabs who are living there peacefully. And you're pointing to some example of how, you know, there's
you're
a
being
free speech breach. They're being I don't know what you're talking about in that example. You can send it to me later, but I'm sure it's going to have something to do with like seditious speech against the state because they're opposing the war or something like that. I'm sure it's some bullshit overreach that the Israeli right is pulling off.
No,
it's not because
The quote was that civil rights lawyers say that Israel is now interpreting any solidarity expressed with Palestinians in Gaza as incitement to terrorism.
Okay. How do you think that if the shoe was on the other foot and you had Jews doing that in Palestine, they'd be treated?
Perhaps arrested? I mean,
perhaps
like, this
arrested.
Is the kind of stuff...
You think a Jew in you think does. A Jew in Rafah would be merely arrested?
If Rafah was a thriving economic hub and
well, of course. I mean, if I had a toilet
resources.
Made of solid gold, then you know my ass would be would be nicer. Like, it's not.
Are you
the Palestinians
solid
have
Rafah
not created
toilet? Like,
no, of course not. I'm saying that you're creating a hypothetical in your mind about
I'm just saying
if Rafah was not Rafah, then it wouldn't be Rafah. Well, congratulations.
No,
I'm talking about what is it like to be. What is it like to be a Jew in Palestine, and what is it like to be an Arab in Israel?
If you had a hostage in your basement, and then you open the door, and they, like, attacked you, you'd be like, well, look, they're just not as civilized as me.
Well, it depends. Look, it depends why the hostage is there and how many times I've tried to get the hostage out of my basement, and they've refused without taking over my house.
Josh.
Well, what if they
don't have hostages.
What if they broke into my house in 1948 and tried to kill me? And then
what if you did the same?
No, there were two states offered. And it's just rewriting history to suggest that a Palestinian state has never been on the cards. It was created in 1948. It just wasn't created on 100% of the land. There was a Jewish state and an Arab state.
These are people that were living on 100% of the land, and then from their perspective, someone comes and says, now you can have a portion of it.
Yes, and from the hostage in my basement's perspective, they're entitled to my entire house. But, like, shit happens, and sometimes countries get carved up, and sometimes there are wars. It's like Israel is the only country in the world that's expected to get repeatedly invaded and then just go back to a truce.
Nobody's expecting that. No.
But it was repeatedly invaded, and now the expectation is...
It was, because it's not doing what it should do, which is... try to live in equality with Palestine. I think if they tried that, then perhaps if you had thriving populations on both sides, you wouldn't be breeding this extremism and nihilism and hatred, right? But well, okay, let's never talk
about.
Been
all right,
tried.
I'll grant you. Let's then talk about the thriving. Where is the thriving, democratic Arab Muslim population in the Middle East that you think the Palestinians would be like?
No.
If it wasn't for Israel.
I am not here to say no. Like
Well, you're saying it's not, within reach. You're saying the only reason why Palestinians are dysfunctional is because of Israeli oppression. So point to the point to the other part of the Middle East where Arab Muslims have a great democracy.
We're not. Why are you bringing other Arab Muslims into?
Because you're saying that
there,
Israel is the fundamental reason why there's Palestinian dysfunction.
You're saying,
so what would the Palestinians look
Islam
like?
Is that
no?
What
I'm
you're
just
saying?
No. I'm not saying anything. I'm asking you. You're saying that Palestine would be flourishing if it wasn't for Israel. What's the other spot in the Middle East that's a democratic
I'm
Arab
saying
Middle Eastern
that
state
they are
that
not
be like?
Flourishing because they've been deliberately economically strangulated. They've
okay,
been
and if
arrested.
They hadn't been,
they've
then
been,
what would they be? What
they
would they
be
living
in a
more
much
like?
Better situation than they
like
are
where?
Now. But I don't have a crystal ball. How can you ask me to predict that? Like how? How am I supposed to predict their future? Come on.
Like Yemen?
No, like I cannot predict what the specific Palestinian people would be looking like if they had a
well, then it's a little bit then it's a little bit rich for the world to say that Israel has to essentially gamble its future security on
but Israel is already
a state
doing
that you can't even say is going to look like anything other than a dysfunctional terrorist state.
How can I say anything? How can I predict the future? But you have to try something that you haven't, like you can't try the same thing again and again. And we have already agreed that that what it's doing right now is not safe for anyone.
Yeah,
it's not
and we agree that there should
anyone.
Be that there should be two states, and we agree that the right is terrible. I mean, we just disagree, I think, about some sort of some basic facts. Like, I mean,
do we agree
more
that
than
the right is terrible, though? Because, like, how where would you
in
place
Israel?
Yourself? No, just generally.
No, I'm talking about the. I mean, generally, I regard myself as a progressive. I regard myself as on the
do
left.
You?
Yeah, yeah.
That's very surprising to me.
Why?
Because I mean, you're on tour with Douglas Murray, who I think is not just on the right. I think he's like.
Yeah, he's
extreme.
Conservative.
He's conservative. He's extreme. Extreme. Like he talks
it depends
about
on
the war
issue.
On. He talks about the war on white people. He writes books that are recommended by like white supremacist groups, like Generation Identity.
Well, you can't control what crazies are going to like what you write. But anyway,
yeah,
I'm
but
not
when
here to talk about Douglas.
The death of Europe.
I'm talking about
I
the right wing.
That,
I'm talking about the right wing in Israel. And
but
the
I'm
fact
trying
that
to place us on the political spectrum in general because I just find it very intriguing that you identify as a progressive. Yet,
but what does a label achieve other than, you know, I mean, like a label doesn't get us anywhere in terms of actual truth
or
facts.
No, but it helps
right?
to add some bearings to the situation.
Well,
right?
so that
like,
only
I mean,
so
you're
that you can only so that you can judge people on the basis of a tribe instead of actually wrestling with the rational
I
points
don't know.
That they're saying.
What do you like? Do you think the IDW is progressive?
I mean, I don't even know what the IDW is. It was a brief thing that Eric Weinstein came up with to try to group together people who now are completely all over the ideological spectrum. I mean, I think I don't know what I would call Brett Weinstein. I mean, a conspiracy theorist and a crackpot.
Sure, yeah, we can agree on
Dave
that.
Dave Rubin is a solid conservative. Who are the others? Majid Nawaz is a conspiracy theorist crackpot as well. I think Sam Harris is a centrist, depending on the issue.
I would call him a conspiracy theorist.
I think
as
Eric
well.
Weinstein claims, I mean, Eric Weinstein and Brett Weinstein, politically speaking, claim to be of the left. I mean, Brett Weinstein voted for Bernie Sanders, so I don't know if a right winger does that. I'm not sure why right and left are necessarily that helpful. I regard myself as being committed to the traditional left-wing principles of egalitarianism, equality, civil rights, the Martin Luther King Jr. vision of the world, the Gandhiite vision of the world.
So you can see the problem with civil rights in Israel. You can see the problem with
yeah, absolutely.
Up, like,
yeah, of course.
Bouncy castles to not allow aid in
I mean, what I'm interested in is the way that we talk about this, the way that we and the rest of the world talk about this, and the way that we live together as Jews and Arabs and find some common terrain on which we sort of apply roughly equal judgments.
So do you agree that Zionism is a form of nationalism?
Yeah, Zionism is a form of nationalism. Yeah, by definition.
A religion-based nationalism.
Well, it's not really religion now, is it? It's the Jews are a weird people. They're sort of like, they're halfway between a non-people and a religion.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I'm not religious, but I'm Jewish enough that Hitler still would have shoveled me into an oven. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I mean, like, I have some atheist friends that are now quite Zionist, I'm realizing.
The basic question about Zionism, I suppose, is should Jews ever have been given a sliver of land to be safe in?
I think
to hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations on Substack.